Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
My guest today is Roland Chambers, whose biography of Arthur Ransome is just out from Faber. Now, you may, like me, have assumed that Ransome spent his life messing about in boats on the Lake District while writing his best-selling children's novels, Swallows and Amazons. But you'd be wrong. He had an extraordinary life story which brought him in contact with the most seismic events of the 20th century. Roland, welcome. Just to start us off and give us a taste of this, could you just read a little bit from your introduction?
I'd be delighted. It is often forgotten that Ransome was 45 when he began writing his most famous books, and that the most interesting episode of his life, from a biographer's point of view, was already over. Between 1913 and 1924, he lived in Russia and the Baltic States, working as a correspondent first for the Daily News and then for the Manchester Guardian. The author of Swallows and Amazons had seen the March Revolution of 1917 with his own eyes, and following the Bolshevik coup in November, became one of a tiny number of foreign journalists granted access to the new Soviet government. During the first years of Bolshevik rule, he had retained close contact with the Kremlin, in spite of the liquidation of a British conspiracy headed by one of his closest associates, an Allied invasion, and a suspicion that Ransome himself was working as a British spy. In the aftermath of the Russian Civil War, he had been in Egypt to cover the assassination of the British governor of Sudan, and in China to document a Soviet-backed nationalist revolution led by Chiang Kai-shek. By 1930, he had witnessed the most formative episodes of the 20th century, the collapse of four empires, the emergence of modern Europe, and the face-off between democratic and communist powers that laid the foundations for the Cold War. If he had ever finished his own history of the revolution, a projected magnum opus sanctioned by Lenin himself, Ransome would be remembered very differently today. But instead he abandoned politics altogether, and with a sigh of relief, embarked on the adventures of the Walker children and their friends. Very quickly, his name became synonymous with an entirely different world.
And that world, as we all know, is Swallows and Amazons, which is still famous. There are clubs all over the world, aren't there?
Very much so. In fact, the first Ransome Admiration Society fan club was founded in Tokyo in 1989.
In 1989?
Well, this is on the internet. There are plenty of societies and so forth before, but yeah, this was the first one.
But this is not the story that we're chiefly interested about here. Tell us a bit about Ransome's early life.
He was a son very much of the Victorian middle classes. His father was a very respectable professor of history and modern literature at the newly incorporated Leeds University. Sadly for Ransome, his father died rather horribly when he was Ransome was 13 years old. He suffered from tuberculosis of the bone, and his leg was incrementally amputated at the ankle and then the knee and then the thigh. So there was a significant trauma in Ransome's life. And yet he had a very happy childhood, and he left university very early. He was worried he'd disappointed his father, but he left university early and became a hack writer in Edwardian London.
So what made him go to Russia?
Ransome says he went to Russia to study fairy tales, and many of his friends were interested in Caucasian fairy tales. But there was another reason. He married young and very unwisely. He was miserable. He had a very young daughter.
He wanted to get away, basically.
And to cut a long story short, he ran away to the only country in Europe that required a passport. And his wife didn't have a passport, and that made life much easier for Ransome while he was there.
Now, you sound a bit doubtful about whether he really wanted to study fairy stories.
No, I'm not doubtful. One of the things that makes Ransome fascinating is that whichever episode of his life you look at, he always has at least half a dozen reasons why he's doing it. And they're all equally true. And Ransome quite happily existed in each of these particular worlds simultaneously. So he did go to Russia as a folklorist.
Before the First World War?
Before the First World War in 1913. Ransome actually had just been prosecuted for libel by Lord Alfred Douglas, who was, of course, Oscar Wilde's lover. Ransome had written a biography of Oscar Wilde, and Douglas had sued him.
For what?
Ransome had suggested that Douglas had ruined Wilde's life. It was a fascinating trial. It was the first public reading of De Profundis, which was the letter that Oscar Wilde wrote condemning Douglas from prison. And thanks to De Profundis, Ransome easily won the case. But the third reason that he went to Russia was that he was horrified by the public attention. So in 1913, he went to Russia, A, to escape his marriage, and his the responsibilities of being a father, B, to study fairy tales, which he continued to do until the publication of one of his most famous books, Old Peter's Russian Tales, in 1916, and also to escape the sort of horror of public controversy, which ironically, you know, dogged Ransom throughout his career as a journalist, because, of course, he was a notorious apologist for Bolshevism, but which he always genuinely loathed.
He genuinely loathed Bolshevism?
No, he genuinely loathed being a figure of public controversy.
Right, let's get this one right. Because his time in Russia involved, he spent Russian New Year with Trotsky and Trotsky's 10-year-old son, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Well, I mean, of course, he found himself in that situation through, as ever with Ransom, a series of quite exceptionally strange coincidences and also willful decisions on behalf of Ransom. He became a journalist in 1916. He was not very well known until the Bolshevik Revolution. He'd actually considered joining the Foreign Office, but they wouldn't have him. So he went back to Russia. He'd been in Russia already for some time. He went back to Russia, was one of the first British journalists to interview Trotsky, realised that there was absolutely no chance of gaining access to the Bolsheviks consistently unless you were very much on their side. I mean, the Bolsheviks weren't prepared to talk to anybody who wasn't very much a pro-Bolshevik journalist. Ransom was very pro-Bolshevik. He wrote a eulogy of Trotsky. One of the reasons he wrote a eulogy of Trotsky was that there was a very pretty woman sitting opposite Trotsky, who was his personal secretary and became Ransom's second wife. And yes, within a week, I mean, this happened at Christmas. Within a week, or rather more, because we're talking about the Russian calendar.
This is 1917.
Mm-hmm. Within a week of his return to Russia and his interview with Trotsky, Ransom was so chummy with the Bolsheviks that, yes, he spent New Year with Trotsky's secretary. I mean, yes, Trotsky's secretary, Trotsky's family, and Trotsky's 10-year-old son. He had an enormous pistol that he used to let off in his chauffeur's ear.
So now tell us a bit about Evgenia. Is it Evgenia? Is that
Evgenia.
Evgenia.
I think.
Anyway. And this is sort of one of the pieces of original research that hasn't actually been written about before.
That's right. The last biography of Ransom was written in 1984. And the Russian archives were only open to the public in 1991 with the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So I went to Russia and, with the help of two exceptionally gifted research assistants, navigated this labyrinth, the state archives, and found out a great deal about Yevgenia's family that has never been known before. And she was a quite exceptional woman whose life was quite as remarkable as Ransom's own. She was the granddaughter of peasants, in fact, the daughter of a peasant who became a sort of minor nobleman, which meant very little in Russia. He was a sort of lowly civil servant. Her father died actually very when she was about the same age, or rather slightly older than Ransom was when his father died. So they had this in common. She had been introduced to the Bolshevik Party by a friend of hers who was the daughter of a local chief of police. And this friend of hers, who was only 18 years old at the time, was a secretary on the local branch of the Bolshevik Party. She was one of the very few people Yevgenia was one of the very few people when the Bolsheviks came to power who didn't come out on strike. She was working at the time in the Ministry of Labour, and she didn't come out on strike. And at that time, she met a woman called Rosa Radek, who introduced her to Trotsky. Now, Rosa Radek is a very interesting person because she's the wife of Karl Radek, who I think is really one of the most fascinating and little-known members of the Bolshevik
Who would read spout poetry.
He would spout all sorts of things because Radek never stopped talking. He spoke about a dozen languages. He was the Bolshevik chief of propaganda.
And he became a great friend of Ransom's.
He became Ransom's closest friend in the Kremlin. They were sort of like fraternal twins. In fact, they were born within a year of one another, and they got on famously well. And I don't think this is just because Ransom was enormously useful to Karl Radek, although it's certainly true that Ransom made himself very, very useful indeed to the Bolsheviks. But Karl Radek was simply the brother that Ransom never had in some ways. And they had a high old time together and wrote some extremely provocative political pamphlets in one another's company, you know, which landed Ransom in all sorts of trouble.
Mm. But then, and of course, he did get into trouble. And at one point, he had to get out and he had to try and get Evgenia out without being married to her as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of strange. About the time of the Oscar Wilde trial, Ransom's publisher disappeared with all the rights to his books. Well, he disappeared with all the money of the publisher. It turned out that he was a bigamist and he was running away from the law. And Ransom was always very sympathetic towards this absconsion, despite the fact that it deprived him of a certain amount of cash and peace of mind. And one of the reasons I think that he was sympathetic was that in 1918, when he was trying to get Yevgeny out of Russia, the reason being that British troops were about to invade Russia, and he was concerned that every British citizen that remained in Moscow, including himself and the British mission, would be arrested. So he thought, okay, I've got to get Yevgeny out of Russia, and I've got to leave myself. They decided they would go to neutral Sweden, but the problem was that the Germans were blocking them in Finland, and the British were about to come in, you know, to the east in Murmansk. So it was a very tricky thing, and Ransom, as ever, covered all his options. And he went to Bruce Lockhart, who was then the head of a British mission in Russia, and he said, look, I want a British passport for my wife, for my girlfriend, Yevgenia, but I want her to be my wife in the passport.
He was still married at this stage.
He was still married. He was still married to his first wife back in England. So Bruce Lockhart gave him this passport. And so effectively, actually, until 1924, when Ransom actually got a proper divorce from Ivy, he was, in a way, a bigamist. And I think so. He understood other bigamists.
But he not only was a bigamist, but he arrived in Sweden with 3 million rubles of Russian money in his suitcase.
Yes, that was quite... that was a pretty extraordinary business.
When was this publicly known?
Well, the thing is, Ransom does talk about this in his autobiography, but as ever with Ransom, he only gives you, you know, the most amusing and least detrimental facts so far as, you know, Ransom's constantly concerned that he's going to be accused of betraying the British. He's concerned about his legacy, especially when he's written these wonderful children's stories, you know. So he's concerned that he'll be accused of having betrayed the British if people find out too much about his work for the secret for the Kremlin. But he's also concerned that the liberals, because Ransom always took a very liberal stance, that liberals will condemn him for betraying the revolution. So anyway, yeah, he will talk a little bit about these things in his autobiography. The fact of the matter is that when he left Russia at that time in 1918, just before the British came in, he had a British double passport in one pocket with his own photograph in it and Yevgenia's photograph in it, and a letter from the British consul recommending him, introducing him to the British ambassador in Sweden. So he got the British side covered. But he also, with Karl Radek, managed to wangle a scheme where he would leave and get through the German forces in Finland disguised as a Bolshevik courier. So he was wearing a Bolshevik uniform when he went through Finland, and he was carrying a Bolshevik diplomatic passport, and he was also carrying the Bolshevik diplomatic bag, in which, as you quite rightly say, were 3 million rubles. He never talked about the money, and he just called it rubbish. He said he had some, he talked to his editor, he said he had some rubbish in the bag.
But the British security services knew about it.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. And one of the great mysteries of Ransom is that although he was arrested on one occasion by Special Branch, and although several people and very senior people within the British Home Office, War Office and Foreign Office recommended that he be prosecuted under the Defence of the Realm Act for betraying his compatriots in Moscow and for working for the Kremlin, and they had some evidence that this was the case, that Ransom had been giving away the names of British agents, that he'd been smuggling Bolshevik money and so forth, Basil Thompson, who was the head of Special Branch, decided that there wasn't sufficient evidence to prosecute, and in fact became really quite friendly with Ransom. And one of the really winning things about Ransom is this incredible capacity he has to make friends with everybody under the sun. An amazing ability and a crucial ability during the First World War and the Russian Revolution, if you wanted to stay in one piece.
Mm. Now, there is some suggestion that he may have been a double agent.
Yes. Answer first. Such a complicated question. The fact is that he was a double agent. The fact is that he was paid by the British and officially employed as a spy, and that he collaborated with the Bolshevik secret police, who were called the Cheka, and they were the forerunner to the KGB. And he collaborated with the Cheka without the knowledge of the British authorities, and he told the Cheka things that the British authorities would not have liked him to tell them. Now,
That said, this isn't the Cold War. Britain is not actually officially at war with Russia. It's still negotiating with the Soviet. Ransom doesn't have any massive state secrets to betray. He thinks of himself, you know, if he thinks at all about it, and Ransom didn't much like introspection, he thinks of himself as a peacemaker. He thinks of himself as a go-between. Now, Ransom was often a go-between in ways that served nobody's interest but his own. And that's one of the fascinations of writing about him. But I think it would be a great mistake to think that Ransom was a double agent in the same way that, you know, the Cambridge Five, for example, were double agents.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've called the book The Last Englishman.
Yes.
Why? He's the least English person in some respects.
Well, he didn't. He definitely thought of himself as sort of essentially English. And I think it was one of the sort of privileges of being a man who was obsessed with fairy tales to mythologize his own life. And that's certainly what he did throughout the war and the revolution and beyond. The reason I called it The Last Englishman is, first, because of the children's books. Ransom is often thought of as an author who represents the kind of heyday of the British Empire, that he's really the last true Englishman in that respect, you know, that he's become synonymous with these values of sort of straight talking and so forth, and game playing. Then I meant it ironically. Because, of course, Ransom was anything but a straightforward person. But then, of course, the British Empire was anything but straightforward. Mm. And finally, because when Ransom was in Moscow, in spite of the fact that there were lots of other people around him, he often thought of himself, despite of the fact that a lot of people thought that he was betraying England, he felt that he was the last Englishman who was really championing British values, which was democracy, liberty, and, you know, the championing of the underdog, which was the revolution, and he always felt that he was the underdog too. So in that respect, I think of him as the last Englishman as well, because I think he thought he was the last Englishman.
Now, I'd like to get you to tell me a little bit about yourself. And you've got this intriguing biographical note on the book, which said you worked as a private investigator specialising in Russian politics and business. What does that mean? And what bearing does it have on your research for this book?
Oh, well, you know, I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you. that was it's a very, very interesting episode in my life. I'd been doing a PhD in New York, and I decided I didn't want to continue with it, that I didn't want to be an academic. And I came back to England, and I started writing, but I had no money. And so a friend of mine phoned me up. This is very kind of old school, I suppose, in a way. I mean, this friend of mine phoned me up from Kroll, which is the largest international investigation agency in the world, and they said, would you like to do some work for us? And I said, you gotta be kidding, I'd love to do some work for you. And that was the beginning of several years of freelance work for them, which involved research into Russian companies, to Eastern European companies, into Russian politics. And it was an eye-opener for me. I mean, I'd been studying film and literature before, and I'd never understood the first thing about business. And it gave me a glimpse not just into business, but into a sort of backstage business and politics that very few people are privileged to see, and it was wonderful.
And presumably gave you research techniques, which are quite useful for the writing of biographies.
Well, that's absolutely right. And in fact, a very friendly company, Kroll. The first time I went to Russia to research this book, I realized that I needed a multiple entry visa. And
aha!
Yeah.
A double agent.
No. I went there. I had a single entry visa, but I wanted a multiple entry. I phoned up the Moscow office of Kroll, and they gave me the address of the people that they use when they need to get multiple entry visas. And I went to this building in the center of Moscow. It's called the Vysotka, a Stalinist sort of skyscraper, and went up to the requisite floor, and the corridors got narrow, and I knocked on this door, and I opened it up, and inside were two 18-year-old girls sitting at a desk eating Maltesers, and they were responsible for all the visas in Moscow. It was marvelous. So, yes, they came in very
good. That's a rather episode. It has rather wonderful resonance with Ransom's first meeting with Evgenia, which involved burning a pot of potatoes, didn't it?
According to Ransom, Ransom's brilliant at removing people from their contexts. And it's essential that he remove Yevgenia from her context, because, of course, she was private secretary to Leon Trotsky, who was first Commissar of Foreign Affairs at a time when Russia was about to leave the war and, as a result, leave England and the Allies in the lurch on the Western Front. She knew all about that. and then Minister of War. I mean, Yevgeny was secretary to Trotsky when he was Minister of War, at a time when the British were preparing to invade Russia. So it's very important that Ransom didn't expose Yevgeny to awkward questions. And as a result, when he talks about her in his biography, he says, I came along to interview Trotsky and we had a lovely time, I interviewed Trotsky. And then afterwards, I met this tall, jolly girl, you know, in the headquarters of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Commissariat of Foreign Affairs. She agreed to take me to see the censor, and we got to the censor to stamp my article. And he was this little guy, and he was asleep, and his room was filled with a brown smoke, and it all stank because he had left these potatoes, you know, to boil. And Yevgeny, being very practical, you know, and domestic, and entirely reliable, and wholly unsuspicious.
And her sister was actually running a gulag, wasn't she?
Running a gulag, like a parallel
the gulag.
No, she, but yeah, she's a fascinating person. I am reluctant to judge Ransom's family, you know, that were left behind in Russia to survive under Stalin. If you'd had anything to do with Leon Trotsky, was a feat, a real feat. The fact that any of Ransom's in-laws, of which there were many, I mean, Yevgeny had five siblings, they all survived. It's a miracle that they all survived Stalin's terror. But the fact is that, yes, Ransom's sister-in-law, Yevgeny's younger sister, became a senior official in the Ministry of the Interior, the NKVD. And yes, she became deputy director of the Moscow region forced labor camp. And only resigned, I think, in 1930. I don't know why. Her husband was suppressed. It's mysterious.
So now, after this, where do you go from after Arthur Ransom? There can't be as very many as colourful characters in the world.
We have to invent some.
So you're going, this is your next step, is it? You're going to start writing fairy stories.
I've already written fairy stories. Yeah. My first book was a book for children, and I do love writing for children. I have a couple of non-fiction ideas which I'd rather keep to myself at the moment.
Well, all I can say is watch this space, yeah. Roland. Thank you very much
for coming. Thank you so much. Thank you.